Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. I'm very excited about today's program. Our guest today is a full-bore Alaskan living in Seattle. He grew up in the Valley. Both parents were in journalism. Full disclosure, I worked with his mom, Susan Morgan, at the Anchorage Daily News, and often listened to his dad, Robert Hawk, a former news director at KSK years ago. Our guest is Eric Hawk, member of the rock band Portugal the Man. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, Kathleen. How's it going?
Very happy to have you with us today. You're sitting in your car on a hill, is that right, in Seattle?
I am. I'm up on the top of a hill in the Ballard neighborhood. It was unfortunately, I couldn't be in the studio, so I figured I'd give you the best 4G LTE reception I could find.
Well, thank you.
So, yeah, I found the highest hill in Ballard, drove my car on up, and I wish I was in the studio with you. I've got quite a bit of fond memories growing up. My dad was the news director of KSKA. Again, full disclosure.
Yeah.
And actually, yeah, growing up, I. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was going to encourage you to tell me the story of when you were 13 and were doing station IDs here at KSKA. So that I was going to tease you into giving us a sample of your 13-year-old self.
Well, luckily, any of those bumpers that I would have recorded back in the day. You know this. You've been in radio a while, but they recorded to carts and to tape and reel-to-reel and things of that nature that don't exist anymore. So luckily, you won't be able to hear my prepubescent voice trying to work out the station ID. But I did do a couple of them, and let me check the time and just go ahead and say, you're listening to KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage. KSKA News Time is 2 minutes past the hour, and here's the news. And then you would go and just hit the button, and that was that. It was a blast. It was a really, really fun way to kind of get free babysitting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was probably pretty fun to push buttons and actually do something instead of just wait for your dad, right?
Yeah, or push buttons when he's not looking, yeah. And then figure out what they do after the fact.
Well, in case anybody has been on the moon and doesn't know, I just want to tell folks your latest album, Woodstock, won a Grammy for Best Pop Duo Group Performance in January, and they have a smash hit, Feel It Still, that kind of leapfrogged over their really comfortable standing in alternative and college rock playlists, and it became number one on U.S. alternative songs, but it also was their first entry into the Hot 100, reaching number four, and it also reached top 10 in 18 countries, from Australia to Norway to Slovenia to Spain to, of course, Portugal. So, I mean, it was a new kind of music, a new breakthrough, and brought you to many, many new audiences, right?
The strange thing is, I don't know that it was like a new kind of music or genre for us. It was definitely like getting onto the pop radio stations is mm-hmm. a shock. That was never part of the conversation. It wasn't until it had already hit number one at some of the alternative charts, in the college charts, that, you know, that conversation even started to begin to happen. And, you know, we're on Atlantic. Atlantic's no stranger. Atlantic Records is no stranger to pop artists. They've got, you know, Bruno Mars and Ed Sheeran over there. But the thing is, they, you know, those teams and those radio handlers work in offices that we're just not allowed to go into. Mm-hmm. You know, they're cleaner and brighter and shinier. And, you know, all of the lights have been replaced recently, and it smells better over there. So that was really our first invitation into that world. And, you know, we're like looking around the room, we're looking at ourselves, and, they're telling us, you know, we're gonna put you on the charts with Justin Bieber and Taylor Swift, and I'm just looking at my friends and looking at my dirty shoes, and I'm like, all right, good luck.
Good luck with that.
turns out, those guys are really good at their jobs because uh-huh. they managed to sell our snake oil into a mainstream top 40.
And, oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a juggernaut. You know, that mm-hmm. song went stratospheric. It did things that I don't think any of us ever expected. Certainly no one at the label, you know, as it was coming out, was like, oh yeah, this is the year that Portugal the Man is going to kick Ariana Grande out mm-hmm. of her number one spot at top mm-hmm. 40.
Right.
Here we are. There must be a gas leak in the world.
You fell in.
We snuck in there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to put out our phone numbers here because Alaskans may want to send their well wishes to you. But I also want to let folks know that, you know, we'll talk about some songs. We'll talk about what the music means. But we also have the chance to learn a little bit more about Eric. And 10 years have passed since you had a serious injury, and I don't think it slowed you down one iota. But I think that's interesting to know and understand, and how you've sort of made a mission to say that to people, to do PSAs for groups where people have undergone something traumatic in their life, a physical injury, and are trying to come back. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit about that. And I know you have a couple songs that you want to talk to us about that are out on the album, but you have some good stories. So let me just say, please check our website, alaskapublic.org, because we've got lots of interviews with Eric and Zach and John, and samples of them performing and lyrics and all kinds of stuff. So if you just want to go down the Portugal the Manhole, just you can do it on one website. And I also want to let folks know we welcome your comments or your questions for Eric today in Anchorage. We're at 550-8433. And if statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And of course, we would welcome any email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I see we have some coming in, so we'll get to those in a while. So, Eric, why don't we just explain Portugal the Man, the name? People asked me. People okay. said, would you have them explain that? And I said, okay, I know Eric can do it. So go ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, when we were all getting our projects together, again, like I joined Portugal the Man a little later. I've been in orbit with the band since the beginning, and I grew up with two of the guys, with the lead singer John Gourley and the bass player Zach Carruthers. So, you know, we were putting our projects together and playing in basements and garages and stuff. We never thought that anyone would write about us or that I'd be getting interviewed and, you know, have to explain the band name with unnecessary superfluous punctuation in it.
Yeah.
But turns out if you stick it something long enough, you know, it takes on a life of its own. So it's with the Portugal the Man thing, the idea there is it's sort of an alter ego. It's kind of the Ziggy Stardust or, you know, how the Beatles did Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It's kind of a way to put on a different mask and, you know, get out there. And, you know, that wasn't me that said that. That was Portugal the Man that said that.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's fun. It's a little level of incredulity. The reasoning behind the name and the full stop is a little bit more complicated. But essentially, you know, going back to the whole pop thing, we're not a singular entity. We're not like one pop star, like a Michael Jackson or a Justin Bieber or anything. We're a group of guys, and we're always going to be a group of guys. Portugal the Man's always going to be a band of people. So the thinking there was, you know, a country is a group of people with one voice in the world. And we kind of just arbitrarily picked Portugal. Honestly, no one is Portuguese. No one speaks a lick of Portuguese. No, I know obrigado, and that's about as far as I go. We've been to Portugal. We do very well in Portugal. Portugal,
I guess.
A lovely country.
Yes.
An absolutely lovely country. But yeah, our picking for that was sort of arbitrary.
Yeah.
It sounded like a cool, masculine, tough name. And, you know, we put the full stop in there, put the period in there to differentiate us from the country because we're not affiliated, although we do enjoy using their name. Thank you very much, Portugal. Obrigado. we put the period in there because our guy's name is Portugal and Keith's the man.
Yeah, I read
that character.
I read one story that said that John Gourley planned to write a book about his dad and give it that name. Is that anything that is credible, or have you ever heard that?
That's got some weight, and I've heard him talk about that. I think that was early on.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you're talking about more than a decade ago, and I think the conceptualization has strayed ever so slightly since that moment.
But, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think more to the point that John's such a creative, like he's got a buzzy brain and he kind of needs to have this frenetic output of artistic flow. So,
well,
you know, the majority of the album artwork is, you know, original art by him, and, you know, these sort of these long, winding kind of story, like narrative-based songs. Those are all straight out of his brain. And I'll watch him just sit down and write an entire, you know, just pages and pages of linear thought. So I think with the wanting to create a book and a story of legends, like, he's just always looking for another output to get those thoughts out of his brain and onto paper.
Well, Eric, I've got a caller, and the cue for me is it's a dad shout-out. Since we just mentioned that one of the original reasons for Portugal the Man might have been a book devoted to John's dad, let's hear what Bill has to say. Hi, Bill.
Hey, yeah. Hey, man. Great. First off, congratulations, man. To make it in the music world these days is unbelievable. Like you said, there's a gas leak. And your dad was probably one of the most down-to-earth people that ever walked. And we were really lucky
man.
To have him. He was really cool.
Yeah, my dad was a rare bird, for sure. I don't know
he was. You know, and I mean, you looked at him, you were like, oh, God, I don't want to cross that guy. You know, but it's true. But anyway, so where did you grow up, in Anchorage or in Seattle? Where'd you go?
I grew up kind of at the base of Hatcher's Pass until I was seven, out there. It's technically Palmer, but, you know, kind of out in the sticks. And then from 7 to 18, I lived in Wasilla. But my parents both commuted into Anchorage every day. You know, my mom started at the Frontiersman out in the valley as an editor there, and then worked her way up to becoming the arts and entertainment editor at the Anchorage Daily News. And my dad was the news director over there at KFKA. So we lived in the valley, but they were always going back and forth. And I definitely got some free child daycare at both of those newsrooms growing up quite a bit.
Great way to grow up. So along the way, did you ever meet Robert Howard, the guitar player from Palmer?
Oh, no, I don't think I did, no.
Robert, meet Lindy Raines? He's another great guitar player, lives up in Fairbanks, a couple local guys. I was just wondering if you had any experience or exposure to people up here, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my dad always had kind of pickup bands growing up, and I always had I just call them kind of my collection of uncles. You know, no relation, but there was always a couple of mustachioed and bearded dudes playing guitar or bass or drums or keyboards, you know, in my living room, or I'd go out and, you know, go to pick up jams with my dad. So growing up, yeah, I was always playing with you know, people my age and people twice my age and people three times my age. You know, just kind of always any opportunity to pick up an instrument and kind of exercise that vocabulary.
Okay, one last question. Are you guys making vinyl? Is it selling? And if it is, you're right after the Pixies and the Police. That's not a bad place to be in the bins.
Alphabetically, we're set. Absolutely.
We are. That was smart.
We've got 8 full length albums on vinyl. I'm a big believer in vinyl. You know, I've moved a bunch, and I've packed up all my belongings and moved from place to place. And, you know, the first thing I always pack up is my old Marantz receiver and my turntables. Gotta have them. And all those records are always coming.
Okay,
with
I'm going to buy one. What's the first one I should buy? What's your recommendation? I don't own anything. I've never even listened to you guys, but I'm excited.
Oh man, I think just in terms of kind of storytelling and like good rock and live guitars, I think Churchmouth might be my favorite record. I think that one sounds incredible on vinyl. It's got kind of that warm raw thing, and the drums are huge. Really, really kind of John Bonamy drums and great guitars. That's a great.
Who is the drummer?
Hey, Bill, I've got to go to some other
conference. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
His name's Jason Seacrest. He's a wizard. He's a great drummer.
Okay.
And a good man.
Okay. So I'd like to welcome Safe from Anchorage on Hometown Alaska. Hi, Safe.
Hi.
And you have
Hey.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you guys so much. You were up here for the grand opening of the Hard Rock Cafe, and it was a moment that my sister and I together will never, ever forget. We kind of got a private show because it was before everything, and it was just a great experience, and I just wanted to really thank you guys.
Oh yeah, crazy. That's it was a while ago, and the crazy thing is I wasn't touring with them yet, so I was up there for it, and I was hanging out with family and hanging out with them. But at that point, I was still playing just really sporadically with them, so I didn't have a guitar to get up on stage and play that, but I was there. And yeah, they still talk about it. They talk about that night being being pretty wild and just having a great time. We're finally getting a chance to play a couple of really big shows up there at the end of October. Kathleen can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's October 26th and 27th. We're up there playing the Alaska Airlines Center, so that'll be a nice full circle kind of hometown crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
Great. Well, we'll be there again.
All right. Thank you, Safe.
All right.
And
we'll see you then.
One more caller. I'm sorry, I want to get to Feel It Still, but let's welcome Michael onto Hometown Alaska. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Kathleen. How you doing?
Very well. Oh, Michael Howard, I recognize your voice.
Great.
What's on your mind?
I have some things on my mind. I wanted to say hi. Thanks for doing the show. So we've got so many musicians from Alaska over the years, including myself, and so many have moved down to Portland and made some really conspicuous, successful careers. And I wanted to see if you and Eric have anything to say about, like, what can we do to make music come from Alaska instead of losing it all to Portland? And I know Portland's super cool,
yeah.
But yeah, I wanted to see if you have any thoughts there with Portugal the Man in the middle of it. And thanks.
I absolutely appreciate that, Michael. Thanks a bunch. I think most of it is just down to the fact that, you know, when we fly or tour or travel, we've got, you know, at the bare minimum, about 50 to 60 pieces of gear, about 100 pounds of pop, and then whatever we can rent backline-wise, and, you know, bass amps, drum sets, whatever we can rent, we will. But we're still flying with a ton of stuff on our back. And just to do the flight from Anchorage to Seattle or Anchorage to Portland or any of those other kinds of places, airfare notwithstanding, your gear, you have to pay for all that stuff that you're checking. And it just gets incredibly expensive, especially since, you can do Anchorage, you can do a couple of spots in the valley and do Fairbanks, but you can't really drive, you know, a couple of coaches with trailers, a couple of 40-foot buses up the Alcan and continue the tour that way. So I think it's getting better. I think that airfare prices, you know, are still kind of prohibitively high, but it is getting better in terms of the production companies up in Anchorage, like Whistling Swan started a bunch of this stuff back in the day, but just the ability to rent backline gear, or for venues like Chilicoots or, any of those other places to have availability where you don't have to fly with all that stuff. They're like, oh yeah, we've already got an Ampeg bass amp and a drum set ready to go. They're set up, they're mic'd. All you guys need to do is get on an airplane and fly. I think stuff like that just helps, you know, helps musicians get up there, and it helps local people that are trying to make it up there as well. Like it's hard to travel and travel around with that much gear and to, you know, pull trailers in the snow that are full of rock band stuff is pretty difficult. So I think it just comes down to equipment and the availability of it. And I think it's getting better.
Mm. All right. I think what we should do is take a little break and come back. And thanks, Michael. We're going to just take this tiny break, come back, and we'll start with, once we're back, a little bit of chatter, but we will listen to Feel It Still and hear the story behind it and the story behind Woodstock, too, because that has quite a story about how it came to be. So you're listening to Hometown Alaska. This is Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Keep my hands on myself. 1966 now. I've been feeling it since 1966 now.
All right, welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I have Eric Hawk on the phone with me from Seattle, member of Portugal the Band, the Man, and we just listened to Feel It Still because we've got a great engineer that just took that advantage of the break to just go ahead and play some of that so that we could start back and talk a little bit about it. And I have listened to lots of interviews and read lots of interviews, but I'd like to hear it from you, Eric, about you know, what that song means, how it was created. It's not to say that it was created in a different way, but it was kind of relaxed, I guess, from the what I've read. So tell us a little bit about Feel It Still.
It's a little different. it's just a really natural thing. Basically, I'll kind of work backwards in the origin story here, but the song came about really easily. That's our singer John playing that bass. He just picked up an old 1960s Paul McCartney style Beatle bass, an old German Hofner bass, and he started thumping around on that bass line. And our friend Asa Tacone, who's a wonderful artist, he fronts a band called Electric Guest, and he's just kind of this enthusiastic, friendly, theatrical kind of guy. He hears that and he kind of starts jumping around and like making whoops and clapping his hands. And he's like, we got to record that. So he throws a mic on the bass amp and John, keeps playing it, and they kind of get a loop together and put a beat to it. And basically Asa just put a microphone in front of John's face and was like, you got a melody? You got a hook? And the whole Rebel Just for Kicks lyric is something that had been kicking around for a long time. It's just kind of a cool statement, and it kind of paints a quirky, mischievous picture. So we've been trying to work that into something. But the melody that you're hearing there is a straight lift of an old Marvelette song, Please Mr. Postman. And that was just sort of the first thing that came to mind, the first melody that sort of came to mind and fit. So it was supposed to be a placeholder. It was supposed to just kind of sit in there until we figured out something else that, wasn't copyright infringing and was original and kind of came from us. But, we flash forward months later and we start looking at the song and we're like, well, this just came about way too easy. Like, we need to retool this. We need to mess with this. So we tried easily 50 different chorus melodies in there. Tried to come up with a bunch of different lyrics on the fly. At one point, our plane got grounded in Madrid. So we just went to a hotel, and John and Zach and I sat in a hotel room and rewrote the lyrics, 20 different ways. Ultimately, we still used the Please Mr. Postman melody and paid the Marvelettes writers and paid the Motown writers for it. Basically, gave them about half of the publishing off that song. Went back to the original lyrics, and that was that. It turns out that our first instincts were right on that one. And, I think still hearing it now, it still sounds fresh to me. I've played that song hundreds of times. I've heard it easily 1,000, 2,000 times, and it still gets me. It still gets me going. So there's something that was working there.
It does make you want to move. It makes you want to just move. And I did hear John talk a little bit about he's got a little girl, and that some of the inspiration for that song comes from seeing his little girl growing up. But it's also, there's the context of the whole album that it's on, Woodstock. So fill us in a little bit more on where the band was coming from when it decided to work on something called Woodstock.
Well, I'll go real quick and just finish shading in some of those lines. But basically, that John's little baby girl, a lot of the lyrical stuff in there is him not being able to see her grow up, or watching her grow up kind of in stop motion animation, where we're gone for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, and you come back to a 6-year-old that's a 7-year-old all of a sudden, and that's a quantum leap. She's growing up so fast. And I know it's hard on John. He FaceTimes with her multiple times a day, like 10 times a day. I hear him, you know, just ringing her up and staring at his phone and being like, "Hi, buddy." It's adorable, but it's heartbreaking at the same time.
Oh, it is. It is heartbreaking. Yeah, yeah.
I think some of that is just a little bit of a love letter to Frances.
Yeah.
To let her know that he's thinking of her.
Right.
The Woodstock thing is
Before we leave that, just to help me with the I'm a rebel just for kicks now. It sounds a little cynical. Sounds a little jaded.
It's sort of a little tip of the hat to Mike D and the Beastie Boys, the fight for your right to party.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a similar narrative on that, where, you know, it's kind of like that George Carlin thing where he's just mad as heck about everything, and he's ranting, and he's calling out hypocrisies in the system and trying to educate people on political issues. But at the same time, the guy doesn't even go out and vote. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's a little hypocritical. So, I think it's just it's kind of a ridiculous notion. But it's a little bit of an inside joke too, just mm-hmm. with the fight for your right to party.
Mm-hmm.
Get riled up, but have nowhere to go.
Right, you know, but I didn't think it was a message to not vote. You know.
Oh, we are very passionate about please, please vote. Please, whatever you do, go out there, voice your opinions, yeah, and exercise your rights,
yeah,
please.
Yeah. So put it in context with Woodstock, because that there's kind of an interesting dad story and, you know, a lot of effort before this album that kind of got shelved. And tell us a little bit about that, because you were with the band when all that started to transpire.
I was fresh in the band and really excited about sort of this epic magnum opus that we were working on. Basically, you know, I came in and sort of helped, you know, categorize and record on and, figure out these like 60 songs or so that we're working on. Just this enormous amount of material and different versions of those songs. And they're just a huge work, this enormous catalog. So, you know, going through it, getting excited. We've got the name picked out for it. We got the concept. We're starting to work on the cover art. And a little bit more backstory, basically in the years leading up to this record, the band had put out pretty much an album, like one album a year. Just a lot of material coming out. And then we put out a record called Evil Friends, and there's a 4-year gap from Evil Friends to Woodstock. That was four times longer than, you know, any other amount of time. And the reason for that is we were, you know, busy making this this epic kind of sprawling thing. But the thing about the record that we were getting ready to put out is it addressed none of the changes that were happening in the American political climate. You know, just didn't talk about the elephant in the room at all. And it just kind of seemed disingenuous to put out a record about, you know, food and mountains and landscapes and, you know, whatever, and not talk about what's kind of putting some fear into our generation. And, you know, whatever side of the coin you're on, there's certainly a lot to discuss there and a lot to unpack and talk about.
Right.
So that, you know, these sort of thoughts and feelings all kind of coalesced with John Gourley's dad, whose name is also John Gourley, who's a wonderful Alaskan Iditarod finisher, just a very practical, construction-based, mustachioed kind of guy. And his hot take on it was basically like, what is taking so long? Like, why on earth are you guys overthinking this? Don't you just kind of go into a studio and record your songs and bam, there's your record? Because the way he's thinking about it is when he needs to, you know, get his friends together and build a house, he gets his materials, he gets his tools, he goes out there and he does it. You know, there's no hemming or hawing or grand artistic license that needs to be taken there. You just get it done.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of this wake up, you know, shake, like give us a little shake and wake us up. And around that same time, you know, he's just a really good storyteller, and he's a really funny guy.
Like father, know, like son, huh?
Absolutely. And I know around that time, he also just sort of nonchalantly offered up his old ticket stub to Woodstock to John, to our singer John, and just like a completely nonchalant way, like you'll get a kick out of this. Here you go. And there it is, you know. Mm-hmm. It's in, you know, the red and white paper flesh. There it is, $8.
$8, wow.
$8 for Woodstock, $8 for to go see Hendrix do the national anthem, and to, you know,
yeah,
see Richie Havens saw a guitar in half, and CPR, yeah, and Santana, and oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So you know, like looking at where we're at now and looking at where we were at then, I think just having the whole conversation about, you know, what political upheaval looks like and the climate that we're in looks sort of similar to coming out of the 60s and coming out of McCarthyism and, you know, getting away from Nixon and getting away from sort of this political climate that might be driven more by fear and, you know, making some art and bringing people together. And that just all kind of came together all at the same time.
Yeah. I just wanted to note, we found here that Barack Obama had made Feel It Still, made it his playlist of the year. So he's hearing you.
Get out of town with that. That's the craziest thing.
Yeah.
Where do you go from there?
Yeah.
The coolest. I think that was kind of before. No, I guess it had gone to pop radio after that point, but that was still pretty early on in the song's life, in the song's life cycle. So that was shocking to us. That was just unbelievable. We always talk about the moment that we kind of knew that we had something special with the song was Kathy Lee and Hoda were picking it early on as one of their songs of the summer.
Hmm.
And then the next week, Lars Ulrich from Metallica picked it as one of his songs from the summer. We're like, okay, that's a very, very, very wide net to cast.
Yeah.
if we can get Kathy Lee and we can get Metallica, like there's appeal.
Gotta
be people in the middle. There's got to be some people in the middle there.
Yeah, that's amazing. You're not tired of hearing it, but we are going to take a little break, and we're going to come back and listen to another song. And I'll also give out our numbers again. I forgot this segment. I know folks want to wish you well, and we want to make it easy for them. So we'll be right back. I'm speaking with Eric Hawk of Portugal the Man. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
I can see it in your eyes, see it in your face, banging on your chest, acting tough, looking unfazed, tripping over landlines, cutting deep with a dull blade, running out of unrest, going out of your mind.
Lonely days will follow, days will follow, and the gangs that stalk the halls will know your
hit me like a tidal wave.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I'm on the phone with Eric Hawk of Portugal the Man. And before we talk about Tidal Wave, which was what was just played during our little intermission there, I'm just going to throw out our phone numbers because I don't mean to forget to do that. 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 around the state, or hometown@alaskapublic.org as an email. And, you know, we do welcome you to call and interact with Eric. We feel so lucky to have him on the air. But you promised me, Eric, that you had a few stories around Tidal Wave. So let's hear what those are.
Well, it just kind of makes me think. I was just kind of smiling and laughing to myself as I was hearing it play back. Because I don't know where that final guitar take was recorded. We recorded that in four different studios in three different states. And I think that just kind of sums up what it is to record at this point and make music. You can kind of just pack up a laptop and bring your favorite microphones and, you know, a good pair of headphones, and everything else is so portable.
Right.
It's really, really fun.
You can buy socks if you need them, but you don't need to carry everything. Yeah. You're down to the essentials for the mission that you have, huh?
Yeah. And, you know, we bring nice stuff. We've got good microphones, and we've all been doing this long enough that I think we know how to get pretty decent recordings, you know, in dirty green rooms of questionable clubs in the middle of nowhere. You know, mm-hmm. you can still get a good vocal take, you know, mm-hmm. wherever you are. But yeah, like with that song in particular, it's just so funny. I had deja vu so many times, just like sitting up, putting on headphones, sitting in different studios, playing it and being like, I swear I just did this last week.
But, here we are again.
But ultimately, I think it sounds pretty good. It just totally depends on where you are. And I think the fun thing about how portable all this stuff is now is you can kind of capture the energy of a place that strikes you. Mm-hmm. You know, not too long ago, I think last summer we were on tour in Switzerland. We were just in a little town called Winterthur, on the German side. And, you know, we're getting ready. We're setting up. It's still kind of early afternoon. Everyone's just kind of sitting around checking their phones, doing whatever. And then, I think our keyboard player Kyle noticed that in a side room, kind of adjacent to the green rooms, there's this really old, kind of funky, out of tune, beat up old upright piano, kind of like you'd see in like an old West saloon,
mm-hmm.
one of those style, like just out of tune enough so it's kind of warbly and fun. But there's just something about it, and it's just kind of isolated in this perfect little room that's got, you know, a nice rug to kind of soak up some of the echo, and it just sounded incredible. So we go in there, set up a couple of microphones on either side of it, and we just start writing with it. And I think by the time that we actually hit stage 6 hours later, we had written, you know, 4 or 5 complete songs just off of this piano.
Wow.
So I think that's kind of the fun thing about where we're at with technology, is it just gets to come with you. And if you're like, this is the most incredible sounding elevator I've ever been in, you can capture that.
Well, it also speaks to kind of I mean, you're recording while you're touring, right?
Yeah, we have to, because we're on the road all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I think I read somewhere that you were on the road 300 days last year or something like that. I mean, so if you're going to live up to your goal of producing albums, you don't get to stop touring and take a break and create, and so it's all happening at the same time.
Yeah, and you should see how some of our hotel rooms end up looking when we're really getting into it. Mm-hmm. There's this microphone set up all over the place, and six mm-hmm. pairs of headphones all tangled up together, and you know, mm-hmm. a computer that's overheating, just whirring away on the bed.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta take advantage of those moments, and if something's banging around in your head, just because everything's so small, you have no excuse. You can at the very least pull out your phone and record a voice memo of it, and then flush out something else later.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, all of our phones and all of our laptops look like just if you look at the file directories, I'm sure they make no sense to anyone else. But you know, it's the diary of a bunch of madmen constantly plugging away,
creating and performing. And I know that I read somewhere that all of that material that was kind of set aside was not really dumped. It just, the timing wasn't quite right for the topics you were. So we probably will see some of that material coming forward. If you've got them in your laptops and, you know, you've got versions of them, we're probably going to get to hear some of that over time.
I do like this sort of romantic image that, you know, we set the hard drives on fire and walked away from it all, and that was it. Just throw the computer in the toilet and be done with it.
Yeah.
No, that stuff all exists. And even if we had wrecked all the hard drives and stuff, it, you know, those parts still bang around in your brain. And there's some really interesting, really cool stuff on there. We were working with great people. We were kind of revisiting stuff with Brian Burton, Danger Mouse, and you know, we were working with Mike D from the Beastie Boys.
Yeah.
What a legend.
Yeah.
He's one of the most creative, exciting people in the world. And yeah, it was like we were coming up with really cool, fun stuff. If it's worth coming back around, it will, you know.
Yeah.
And already some of those songs have been cannibalized and retooled and reworked, and you know, you take a part here and you put it in there and presto.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah. Well, I did want to bring up the fact that 10 years ago you had a really difficult thing happen to you, and I'm thinking of it now because I've got a caller on the line that I'm going to welcome here in a minute, and he's raising the issue of disability rights, and I know that you have become something of a spokesperson for people still reaching out and grabbing the world they want, even if they have experienced a setback of some sort. And so I do want to talk to you a little bit about, I think it was 2007 when your accident happened in Seattle.
It was, yeah. It was May 2007.
And I think that it was a very relaxed moment for you, but some wall gave away and you dropped down and injured your back and essentially lost use of your legs, right?
Yeah, I kind of fell into someone's little project addition on their house. Basically, they were digging out a foundation and leaning against a wall, and the wall fell back, and down into the foundation I went. So what essentially happened is I'm a paraplegic now, complete paraplegic. They would call it a T4 level. So basically chest down. With the advocacy thing, that's all just kind of been this weird, long, wild progression. I never pictured myself as an advocate. I'm not a terribly public guy. I don't do a lot of public speaking or interviews, contrary to what we're doing right now. but it was just one of those things where I obviously have a very visible job. You know, I'm up on a stage in front of people every night, and I also happen to have a very, you know, visible disability. And I think with that and with me, you know, going up on the stage every day, I'm just up there, you know, doing my part and playing my job. I'm not, you know, spreading an agenda or, you know, really necessarily, you know, spreading my message by doing that. I'm just kind of existing. But the thing about it is, you know, pretty much everyone, I think it's one out of six Americans has a disability. And so that's everyone either has a brother or sister, father, mother, cousin, friend, whatever it is, like you probably have someone that's dealing with some type of disability in their life. Whether it's, you know, visible or not is a whole different thing. But, you know, a lot of the time, it's just kind of a difficult world if you're on wheels. You know, there's a lot of stairs in the world, and there's a lot of sand and grass, and it can kind of, if you're not careful, you know, it's easy to just kind of stay still and not do the things that you really want to do just because you're worried about either being a burden or it's not going to be available or accessible to you. So for me, like I'm just kind of in a position where I have to play those shows. Like if I don't want to go play a festival that's covered in tall grass and sand, that means that my band doesn't get to either. And I don't want that kind of pressure. So we're going to figure out a way to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just by, you know, kind of thrusting my face into a bunch of different venues and scenarios and situations, it shows other people that there's nothing to be, you know, there's no reason to hold back.
Yeah. And I do believe that I read that you were rehabilitating for roughly 4 months and met a deadline with your band at the time, The Lashes, I think. So, you know, I mean, that's amazing. Did you make a decision that I'm going to make it my job to not lose any ground, Or were you just there naturally? That's just the way you... I think I read somewhere that you said you have a truck driver's soul and you have to be on the road or something like that.
So. Yeah, I definitely have that. And I'm enormously stubborn, too. So, basically with that whole deadline, no one asked me if you know I wanted to cancel it. It was on my calendar, and it was still on my calendar when I was in the hospital. And I'm like, all right, I guess we're doing that show.
Yeah.
So that was definitely, you know, that was one of the first times that I had a guitar in my hands. After the accident and everything. So it was. It just kind of was what it was. It was just getting back to work.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Well, let me welcome.
Figuring out that. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Let me welcome Jim on the phone. He's been holding here. Hi, Jim. You're from Palmer, and I can see that you want to ask something about disability rights. And so I just wanted to get that story out there. So what was your question, Jim?
Well, for one, I just so appreciate seeing Eric up on stage. I was hurt 35 years ago, L2-3 para. And I imagine there's a lot of sort of local guitar players and just local people like me who just adore seeing you up on those giant stages in your white wheelchair. I swear I walk 2 feet taller when I do. And I think I just want to encourage your advocacy voice. And I guess I also wonder, is this question just a drag that this always comes up? Because you're such a great musician and guitar player. And I think you'd always be recognized for that first, no matter what advocacy agenda you follow. But I sure hope you do, because you're just so helpful to all of us by just doing what you do, and using your voice is great.
Jim, you just made my heart grow 3 sizes. that's amazing. I with me, it's kind of funny when I'm off the road and you know, I'm not touring. I kind of tend to forget that I'm a musician, but the advocacy thing still sort of, you know, comes around. And you know, luckily I'm in a position now where people do get an opportunity to reach out to me, and you know, reach out through email or social media. And you know, a lot of times it's the people that are going through some sort of disability or some sort of adversity themselves, and other times it's like a parent of someone where they're like, hey, my son is a huge fan of your music, he just got in an accident, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago, and he doesn't think that he can get back into music. Do you have any advice for him? And that's a lot of responsibility. That's heavy, but I do get a bunch of pride from it. And you know, I've sort of taken it as a responsibility that I have, that if someone reaches out to me, I have to, you know, at least give them who I am and give them my perspective on things. So thank you for your words, and please, please, please keep playing music.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Well, you know, I there's so much to talk about. One of the things I wanted to say is it's your birthday in August. You're going to turn 37. The whole band is turning 37, and that's, you know, a point in your life where I know you've talked about, you know. I mean, you were in a band that toured that got signed before Portugal the Man, and I also read that you had basically started maybe getting into business a little bit, maybe partnering with people in some local music venues and bars in the Seattle area, and so that sounded sort of like settling down, you know, or I wondered what that part was about, and then, you know. Getting back in with Portugal the Man, you know, do you literally shut down your apartment and say goodbye to your friends and you're gone for 300 days? I mean, you know, what happens to your life when you know, these guys are your life, but then there's everybody else. So what's it like? And what's it like when you're looking at 37?
Yeah, well, it turns out that, you know, if I would have followed my original dreams when I was a kid, and if I was in the National Basketball Association playing, you know, small forward for the Portland Trail Blazers, I would be, you know, the third oldest player in the league. 37 is about the age that professional athletes retire, and you know, we do have a pretty physical, somewhat physically demanding job where, you know, you're at least on stage for an hour and a half, 2 hours every night, and then there's, you know, whatever whatever, running around and setting up for acoustic shows or, you know, running to different radio stations or hustling around that you have to do during the day. And, you know, it usually goes until like 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning, and then you wake up and do the whole thing again. And, yeah, man, your dogs are barking a lot more at 37 than they were at 27 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a certain benefit to the fact that we've all been doing this and we're all kind of in that age. So no one's out there being Motley Crue or,
yeah,
you know, like, yeah, like really partying. Like we're working and we all watch out for each other.
Right.
And, you know, we all hit the gym in the hotel instead of hitting the hotel bar. And we try and eat right, because, yeah, your metabolism grinds to a halt,
yeah,
around the age that we are.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think it's kind of a little bit of a benefit, too, of just having done it for so long. You know, I've been hustling around selling tickets to my band's shows for more than 20 years at this point. And, it's meant different things. Like the show experience has meant different things to me over the years, but it's still basically the same job. So you kind of develop a routine and figure out how to get it done.
Yeah. I think you're driven. There's this thing I read that, you know, we never want to sing the same song twice. We never want to produce the same album twice. So there's this thirst to get out on the road, to get to new places, to meet people. And that must be something that's driving you, the quest for newness.
I will say, that's mostly the case, although, you know, with Feel, it's still, I never get sick of playing or singing that. I know a lot of the other guys have kind of said the same sentiment. Like just particularly with that song, it's a pain in the butt. It's a super, super high vocal that if you're doing it at a radio station at 7 in the morning, like you better clear your throat and get ready to hit that high note.
Yeah.
I think we're all kind of wired similarly, where, you know, like the pirate's life is the life for me.
yeah.
I don't think it's a normal thing. I don't think that most people would look at my schedule, especially just like my schedule for an average 24-hour period, let alone, you know, the being gone all the year kind of thing. It's like I'm gone all the year and then, like, just stacked from the wee hours till very, very late every night. And it's pretty crazy, but I get really stir crazy when I'm home for more than like a week. You know, I come home, I pay my bills, I deal with the massive mountain of mail and bills and advertisements and Valpak coupons that still gets into my mailbox. And, you know, I get home, I take care of stuff, I check in on my businesses, and then I'm ready to go again.
Yeah. And let me just ask, are those businesses some sort of diversification for you, or it just seemed like natural?
Yeah.
You know the venues, you know what makes them good. So, you know,
I think you hit the nail on the head earlier, where it's like, oh, this seems kind of like a slowing down, almost like a retirement plan kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I'm a part owner of 2 independent bar and lounges in Seattle, and a part owner of a music venue here, a great music venue in Seattle called The Crocodile, that's been going strong since the early 90s. And legendary spot that a lot of the old grunge places played, you know, Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden all played pivotal,
yeah,
shows at this venue.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that was, you know, I got into all this stuff about 5-6 years ago, and it was a little bit like, let me slow down. The people that I'm playing with, you know, at this point, this is before I'm a full-time member of Portugal the Man. So, I'm mostly in like bands that do, you know, weekend touring, or we go out for a week or two at a time and then come back and we all have jobs. And, you know, with that, you know, making investments in businesses with my friends that I trust, and especially like music centered businesses, is a way for, you know, me to be able to go out and, not have to beg my boss at whatever, you know, shoe store or clothing realtor that I'm working at to give me 3 months off so I can go on the road.
Yeah, it gives you independence.
With the bars, I just, you know, I sort of helped with aesthetics and getting the right people involved and, you know, just sort of the general theme and then getting people hired and hiring the right people and hiring, you know, the right bar managers and the right people to do the books.
Yeah.
And suddenly that is just something that keeps existing and I don't need to meddle in it. And if I do try to meddle in it, you know, I'm just in the way. Like, let us do our jobs. Like, all right, boss, you know it.
Yeah.
It was sort of like I was looking at my life and I'm like, I'm probably not going to tour, you know, at the age of 37, how wrong I was. it was a bit of a contingency plan. And I've been lucky enough to have success in the venue and in the bars.
Yeah.
And they're still plugging along just fine. And,
I've got a question for you. We have about 2 minutes or so, so we don't have a whole lot of time, but I heard an interesting interview in which Portugal the Man was talking about how streaming has really changed the idea that, oh, we're a certain kind of band. Well, listeners actually just make their own playlists and they have all kinds of different playlists and they mix things up. And suddenly genres are not so important anymore. And I think you guys have perhaps benefited from that.
I would say enormously. I think you don't have a song like Feel It Still Do What It Does without that sort of shift in the industry. Our song went to number one in 6 different charts and they were as widely varied as, you know, adult, hot adult contemporary, you know, hot AC, top 40, pop, alternative, adult alternative, like all these genres that don't necessarily have anything to do with each other, but here we are.
Hey, Eric, I've got one more quick question because I know we're going to lose you so fast, but we've got a listener who wants to know, what's the most common response when people hear you're from Alaska?
Let me think about that. That's on the spot.
Sorry.
Most of the time, it's just kind of a wow, you know? I mean, we represent it pretty hard. We go out there wearing AK hats, and you know, I still have my KSKA bumper stickers.
Mm-hmm.
So we definitely wear it on the sleeve. And yeah, I think it depends where you're at. A lot of people just can't wrap their head around the fact that Alaska is American.
Right. Hey, Eric, you probably hear those are closing tune. I'm going to have to say goodbye, but thank you. I so enjoyed talking with you. Eric Hawk from Portugal the Man, headed out tomorrow on tour, I think stopping in Asbury Park to open Springsteen's reopened bar. Thank you so much, Eric. And I'll be back next week on Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska when we discuss victims of crime and the state agency and a local nonprofit that help people navigate the judicial system when they've been victims. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. David Waldron is our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.